what I'd like to do tonight is talk a little bit about the plot or the central thing of the gospel, and then talk about the real big issues of raising children, and then a couple of thoughts about that I have from the gospel which make raising children possible and doable. And I'm going to use some art, I'm going to use some literature, some poetry, but I want to try to talk for just a minute about what the gospel is. Now this may sound a little bit theological, but just give me a few minutes, wherever you're coming from, if you've never heard me before, if you've heard me several times, if you're sick and tired of hearing it, which you wouldn't be, because I've only been here a few weeks. But I'd like to talk a little bit about what the gospel really is. Now, what the gospel teaches, it's a very particular understanding of life, and it's not necessarily, you don't necessarily hear it in Christian churches. Often the gospel is quite different from Christianity. You can go to many churches and actually hear a message that is much more like law or judgment rather than release, freedom, and grace. And so I just wanted to go over just a little bit again what the real message of Christianity at its root is. And I'm going to read a passage in the New Testament because this is the heart of it. Everything that I try to say here, there's a mechanism to it. There's a hidden idea. Let me explain what I mean. One of the best ghost story writers in the history of English fiction was called Montagu Rhodes James, M.R. James. He wrote ghost stories in the Edwardian period. And these ghost stories are powerful, terrifying English stories told by a guy who taught at Eton. And you never know what's going on. You never really know what's going on until the end. And they asked him, how do you do it? And he said, well, when you write a ghost story, you have to have it in your mind exactly what's happened. Who got killed? By whom? What despicable crime has been covered up? And why ghosts are operating in this particular place? But you can't let on to the people, because they have to sort of get it by inference. Henry James did this, famously, in what story? The Turn of the Screw, where you never really know what's happened to create this hellacious scenario. Well, similarly with the gospel message, and don't worry, people are going to be coming. The place will be full in 10 minutes. It will be. Or at least it'll be people, this is the way it is. I've discovered this. So I start on time, and you come whenever you want. And that's no problem. What we're talking about tonight is raising little children. Is raising little children. But I want to start with what the gospel is. And this is what the gospel is. The gospel says that everybody has in themselves a selfish, psychosexual, libidinal, aggressive urge. Those are heavy words, but that everyone has in themselves a selfish, libidinal, psychosexual, aggressive urge that is highly narcissistic and is extremely defensive and is highly angry and threatened. This we call original sin. Original sin is the classic word for what we believe makes people angry and dominating, cruel, and also all the other things that I've included in those words. Now, in the Bible, God gave the law, and the law is supposed to judge those things. But what happens is, when the law comes in, here's the law, and here's sin, or this thing I've talked about, the kind of thing that your dreams are made of, the kind of things that you dealt with in college, the kind of things that you're still dealing with in your relationships, the fact that you can blow up at someone you love in 2 seconds, that you can be married to someone for 35 years, and the whole thing can go south in 5 minutes. That's called sin. The law comes in, God's law, which judges those things. And yet, come to find out, the law, instead of controlling it, ends up increasing it. The moment I tell you not to do something, at that exact moment, what happens? What happens the moment I tell you not to do something? If you want to do it. And if someone with a clerical collar should come in, or someone that you think has that authority, and tells you something not to do, your desire and your need to do it implodes and goes the opposite direction. This is why law, which the Bible is simply judgment or criticism or telling me what to do because they're right about what I'm doing and I'm in terrible trouble, so if my wife can just tell me what to do, I'll get my act together. Or if I just tell my teenage son what to do, he'll get better. This is why it always fails. And all attempts to control behavior by means of law fail. They are doomed to fail because law increases sin. Now, I don't know if you're with me yet, but this is vital. And this is a point that I will repeat, and I'll repeat, and I'll repeat, and I'll repeat, till I'm blue in the face. Now, it's not my point. It's St. Paul and Christ's point. And what St. Paul said in Romans 7 is the following. If it had not been for the law, I would not have known what sin is. I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, thou shalt not covet. Do you understand? I wouldn't have known what was bad unless I'd been hearing of thou shalt not. But sin, my psychogenetic impulse, found an opportunity in the law, and I became more covetous. Apart from the law, he writes in verse 8, sin lies dead. In other words, if I don't tell you not to do something, you won't do it. But if I tell you not to do it, you'll do it. Now you may think that's obvious, and in the New Testament, Paul treats it like a no-brainer, but it is not obvious. All human education, didactic ideas of parenting are located in a false view of the human condition. We think that if we lay down the law to somebody, they will change. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. All parenting is found on that idea. You think that if you tell someone what to do, that they're supposed to do it. And if you have children, you've been doing that forever. Your parents did it to you. And to that extent, you have no relationship with your child, and your child gets worse. This is what the gospel teaches, because he says, apart from law, sin lies dead. Then Paul goes on to say, St. Paul in verse 9, I was once alive, apart from law. But the moment law came, sin revived. In other words, the moment somebody told me what I shouldn't do, at that precise second, I started thinking about it. Just think about it. Did anyone, the classic example, I used to babysit when I was living in Georgetown as a kid. I was the babysitter of, you know, when I was 12 and 13 years old, right? And I went to a house and this guy came to me once and he said, we have all these books, you can read anyone you want, but we also have a couple of books by Henry Miller. In those days, your mom would never want you to know that we even have those books, and under no circumstances ever look at Tropic of Capricorn. So they go, and then finally I put the children to bed, and what do I immediately do? Because I'm a normal person. Immediately, I make a beeline to Tropic of Capricorn, which is very tame, but then it was very cool. Now, this is what he says when he says, when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. The very commandment which should have promised life proved to be death. In other words, I thought I could tell my child what to do. I thought I could help my child become disciplined in school. I thought I could give my child good study habits. And the more I tried to reason with my child, the more incredibly bad he got. Now, am I telling you, is this not right? Is this not obvious?
But more true than young. I think as the testosterone goes down, we become more mature. We have a clue.
Richard has just said that as the testosterone goes down, Socrates said something like what you just said, the older we get, the more open we are to reason. We'll discuss that later on. I hope that's true, and I'm sort of counting on it. But let me continue the point. But thank you, Richard, for sharing. There will be, what we're going to do, by the way, I'm going to talk for about 40 minutes. And then we're going to have some Q&A, and then something else that I hope will make it more interesting to you. But he says that sin had found its opportunity in the law and deceived me. And yet, he writes, the law is holy and good. But let me say what that means. Now, this is in Romans 7. A lot of people don't understand that this is here. That this diagnosis is here. Let me say once again what the gospel is. We're all filled with narcissistic, libidinal aggression. The Bible knows that as original sin. God tells us not to do it. The moment we get told not to do it, it doubles. And it becomes twice as bad as before. This explains adolescence. But it doesn't explain just adolescence. It explains your sister, who's the not straight arrow. It explains your brother, who's never been home for 20 years. It explains one of your children. It explains you. And what happened is, the law, in a gruesome twosome alliance with human nature, increased the sin, and you became a rebel. And you said, to heck with it, I'm not ever going to be with them anymore. What the gospel says is that that's where we are. And if you think that you can talk somebody out of a bad thing or bad behavior, sounds good, but it is an impossibility. Now let me just give you a couple of examples. Phyllis McGinley, there's a man named John Hazard who I've been in touch with recently, and he gave me a 1954 poem by Phyllis McGinley called A Garland of Precepts. And he says, here's the gist of what he or she writes. Here's the gist of what I know. Give advice and buy a foe. Here's the gist of what I know. Give advice and buy a foe. And she ends her sonnet, because it's a sonnet from 1954, The New Yorker. Do not give advice at all. Now, Phyllis McGinley was telling the truth about the gospel. The law, advice, immediately causes you not to want to talk to anybody again. If anyone comes up and gives you advice, I shut down, because I take it as judgment. So, this is Phyllis McGinley. It's called A Garland of Precepts. W.H. Auden, and I'm not going to read his poem, it's just too long and too heavy and too wonderful. He wrote a poem called Law Like Love. Law Like Love. And I have copies for everyone of this poem. Law Like Love. W.H.D. Often artists understand the law and the gospel better than Christians because they're closer to reality. They're closer to the reality of human nature. So read Auden's Law Like Love. And let me give you one other quote. Mary and I are very much fans of Emily Dickinson, although I find Emily Dickinson a little obscure. However, one of her greatest one-liners is this. The etiquette of admonition is questionable. It's a miracle of a one-liner. Maybe you've heard it from Emily Dickinson. The etiquette of admonition is questionable. In other words, she is writing the great, great sage of Amherst, the Belle of Amherst, is saying, if you think that you can get any effect, any change by means of admonition, or telling people what to do, it's very questionable. And so Paul, in the Bible, says that the thing about law, and he was the first person to discover this. The Greeks didn't know it. Plato didn't know it. Aristotle completely missed the boat. And only Paul, followed by Augustine, because it was forgotten after Paul, and later Martin Luther, who understood it, in my opinion, more profoundly than anyone has ever understood this, with the exception of Paul and Christ himself. They understood that judgment increases sin. And what has to happen is judgment has to be borne by another. And that's commonly called the atonement. And so Paul said, because judgment has left the equation, I do not now have to sin. Because judgment has departed the equation, I can now exist. And come to find out, what happens is, instead of becoming like a licentious person, when judgment is released, I become a loving person. And he uses words like the fruits of the Spirit. And I will be trying to say this and express this message day in and day out. And every week someone will come to me and I'll try to be patient and loving and I'll take tranquilizers and the great question will always come back, well, aren't you blessing sin? If we believe that you're right about judgment not helping and only forgiveness and absolution and grace helps, aren't you therefore enabling sin? And I will say, well, according to the New Testament, as soon as judgment is taken away, people flower. People become more loving. They become all the things that Paul talked about the fruit of the Spirit. Now, you and I don't realize this. We treat our children in a different way. Now, I don't know if you're with me on this, but what have I said just briefly? This is so important, and I'll just try to repeat it as clearly as I can week after week, because I have to hear it every day. And you have to hear it every day. Judgment kills. Grace frees and makes alive. The result of grace is not lawlessness, but love. And this happens in families and in marriages and with children. Now, you've come to hear a little bit about raising small children or being small children, or helping small children, or loving small children. And this is a universal message for everybody, whether you have small children or not, because you were a small child once. Now, I want to start out by saying a couple things. There are a couple of, often in cultural life, you get cliches, which people think are true, but they're not. Deeply wrong things. Let me give you an example. People often say, oh, the devil is in the details. Have you ever heard anybody say that? That's repeated all the time as if that's true. It's not true. The devil is never in the details. There's a slight truth about that. The devil is in the big picture. The details are only part of the big picture. If you have the devil is not in the details. I only use that as an example because it's patently a false saying that people have somehow thought is somehow true. There was a period in the history of American presidents when people used to say this, well, I don't know if the president or a public official, I don't really care what he does in his private life as long as it doesn't affect his public life. Do you ever hear that? All you need to do is interview anybody about 9 years ago on the street, CNN. They interviewed 100 Americans and 100% of people on the street said that. I don't care what he does in his private life as long as it doesn't affect his public life. That is a totally false statement. Nothing could be more untrue. If you're having a nervous breakdown at home, it will come into your practice of law, into your work, whatever you're doing. If you're carrying on with someone you shouldn't be carrying on with in your so-called private life, you know, it will in fact find its way into your persona no matter who you are. Now, another cliche is this. Children are, what was the word, Mary? What? Resilient. Have you ever heard that? Come on in. Plenty of room. Children, there's plenty of seats up here, and I love people coming in late. I won't even mention your name, Ashley. Now, have you ever heard this? People will say about little children, oh, children are resilient. You remember that's what our parents used to say? Who here has heard that? Oh, don't worry about it. He's resilient. He's 3 years old. He's resilient. Now, that statement is a completely false statement. There's not an iota of truth. Children appear to be resilient at a certain time if they have shocks to their system. They appear to be resilient, but the least resilient people in the world are little children. Let me explain how this goes. Caspar David Friedrich, the romantic painter of the early 19th century in Germany. My belief, he was one of the greatest painters in the history of Europe. And he painted a picture, which doesn't really express this quite clearly enough, called The Stages of Life in 1855. And in it, in this very powerful painting, he shows little children, a young mother, a young man in full, a man in full, and an old man. And he's simply saying that there's childhood, there's youth, and there's old age. And the last word is old age. But he has placed the children at the absolute basis of the picture. The ship reflects an adult. And he's placed the child at the basis of the ship like an anchor. The actual meaning of this painting is that the child is father of the man. Have you ever heard that expression? Now that is true. Children are resilient is a falsehood. Your children are the least resilient people you know. They are entirely sensoriums of present-day frustration that is internalized, and that is an absolute fact. So look at this picture as a kind of metaphorical, romantic picture of the basis in which the artist instinctively understood that the scaffold of adult life is founded on the child. So, can I pass this around? Just pass it around. I'm not very big media stuff. I have wonderful people. We've got Noel and Susan and others. And one day I'll be PowerPoint, but I hope not. Because I was going to visit a guy in a law firm downtown today, and I had to pass three security stations to visit this person. Three security stations. And everyone had to check that I was on a screen, that I was part of a screen. They never looked at me. Not once did any of the three people, they all had to see that I was on a list, on a screen. It was totally mediated. There was no direct communication. Finally, I turned to the woman and I said, well, if this is post 9/11, I'm going back to Switzerland. I couldn't believe it, because it wasn't just that it was overly secure, it was insane. I felt like it was in Minority Report by Tom Cruise, remember that movie? Not only was it insane, but they weren't looking at me. It was so impersonal. Look at this picture. We're lucky because children are my first point. I gave you the gospel, which is underlying all this, and then I talked about children. Children are in fact only in a very superficial sense adaptable. They are in fact extraordinarily sensitive, and everything that you say to them comes home to you. Everything that they say to you comes home. Now, down at the National Gallery, there is a room called The Journey of Life, and it is four paintings by the American Hudson River painter, Thomas Cole. Some of you know this series of paintings. And he painted them in the 1840s. He was a devout Christian, but not when he painted these pictures. And in the pictures, he tells the real story of life. And here, you can see it. It's down there. It's not in Utica, although it says it's in Utica. It's in Washington. He shows a little baby emerging from the womb with bliss, hope, flowers, sun, majesty, dignity, nobility, and belovedness. This is what a child is. Look at this picture. Go downtown and see it. There's a whole room devoted to it. And take a look at it. Don't look at the one about middle age. Because let us simply say that the scene changes. Pass it along. Now, what am I getting at? My first, what I tried to say initially was that the gospel is about the failure of law or admonition or teaching to correct the human condition in children, because we're all children. Then I talked about the beauty, the fact that we're dealing here with children who are in fact not at all flexible. And in fact, you and I know, one of the things you find out the older you get is that you keep going back to things that happened in your childhood. Now this may not be true of you, but Mary and I have noticed, the older we are, amazed at how things that relate to our childhood come back to us. We are amazed the older we get, and we're in what the world would call high middle age. High middle age, at least in chronological terms. Obviously, I think of myself as a young person. Aren't you amazed at how you go back to things that happened in the early years of your marriage, sometimes, or your first marriage, or your first relationships you had with the opposite sex, or things that happened when your children were very little? Haven't you found that you sometimes go back, and the older you get, the more you go back? Well, We are just very keenly aware of some of the events that occur as we look back on our children's lives. And in light of the gospel, I want to say a couple of things about children. The biggest problem with child-rearing. Now, what I did was I gave you the gospel message. Then I talked about the nobility of children and their sacrosanct character. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the great issues involved in raising children. The first thing about raising children is that many of us way over-attach ourselves to our children. We are deeply over-invested or over-projected in our children. All you need to do, you just see this everywhere you go. It's almost a professional liability of being a young mother, because the sort of urge to over-identify or over-attach to your children is so great that it's almost insuperable. I see this every time I go to the grocery store. And believe me, we've been there. We've raised children. Three terrible children, but we've lived through these things. But every time I go, and I often there's a young mom with a little baby, and it's like she thrusts the baby in my face, and I can't relate to the person. It's like she it's sort of love me, love my baby first, and it's always she's going through the child to the person. Or you see it on airlines. If you go on airplanes, the mother is identifying with everyone else through the child. It's like a curlicue that goes out, and everyone sort of has to honor that. It's not the mother, it's the child, and the mother through the child, and it's a very normal thing. But the characteristic problem that happens in raising small children is, you're going to say I'm being a little bit stereotypical here, but what I'm saying is the way it actually is. This is based on observation, not on prescription. The moms tend to over-identify with little children, and dads tend to be under-involved. As I said last week, when you become a teenager, the dad has to take over. The father is more important for the child, daughter, or son in puberty than the mother. And it's a very, very difficult transition for a mother to get that, because she was the most important person, and when puberty comes, almost overnight, the father becomes critical. But not with little children. With little children, the mother is absolutely key. But the possibility of overinvestment becomes enormous. And this is what happens with the law. Because if you project onto your child your own self, then guilt is going to come into it. If you project onto your child your own hopes, your own being as a person, then this tremendous guilt is going to come in. It has to do, say, with college admissions. If you start projecting onto your child your ideas about college, as opposed to their ideas, I mean Dartmouth, that's the usual one, whatever it is, you are in danger of projecting onto your child yourself. And that's when the guilt and the law comes in. If you have an idea that your child should turn out a certain way, and many of us do, and the child turns out the wrong way, or a different way than you think they should, that's when they never want to talk to you again. They leave you forever. Listen, I'm really helping you here. I mean, maybe you don't need the help. Maybe you're very fact you hear me, you don't. I'm trying to help you to hold on to your children. I have something to say that is related to grace and law from St. Paul that it could make the difference between your actually having a vivid, real, adult, happy, loving, mutual relationship with your adult child when the time comes, and having a strained, alienated, and detached relationship from your adult child. Because if the adult child picked up projection of your life onto them as a little one, and that became part of their whole persona, in order for them to thrive, they have to leave. It's not an optional extra. In order for them to exist, a young man who feels swallowed up by his mother, he, for whatever reasons, this is what happened. It's usually because the relationship with the husband was not good. A young man who feels swallowed up by his mother has to leave. It's not, he, from his point of view, it's a matter of life and death. A young girl who feels entirely and totally dominated, unless she just completely dies and becomes a very sarcastic and angry conformist, has to leave. Has to. It's not an optional extra. And this causes what happens in families. So what I'm trying to tell to you is start at the very beginning of having children to understand that the law usually works in this over-attachment or over-identification with your child, and then that's death. I mean, if you, for example, Mary, you remember when our children would have tantrums? Well, we would be in New York City, and Mary would be coming home, and we had three little children, they were all tiny, and she would have one of those triple strollers in a Gristides in New York. And two of them would be having a total tantrum. And all the little ladies who lived around in the apartment buildings who did not have children would sit there in huge judgment. And Mary would just absolutely die. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, if your child has thrown a scene. And she was pretty good. She would come home a wreck. I would have to just spoon feed her alcohol, but I didn't know. I'm not some cynical Episcopalian type. I would just listen badly. But what would happen is, you see, if you actually identify heavily with how your children act in public, for example, it could kill you. And if they get the idea that your whole being is somehow tied in to how they relate to life, they will leave you. Because, you see, they have to. Law always creates reaction. When what was the first law in the Bible that created the exact opposite thing? Who said that? The Garden of Eden. God said, "Thou shalt not eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil." And of course, that was the only tree that Eve was a teenager. You know, remember that song by the Beach Boys? It's the greatest song in the history of the world. She'll have fun, 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 till her daddy take her, keep her away. You know, she told her old man she had to go to the library, you know, but come along with me, let's have a lot of, you know. Just listen to the Beach Boys, and you will get a positive version of rebellion, as over against any number of other things I could tell you to listen to, where you'll get a dark, suicidal view of the rebellion. But what happens is, the over-identification is a form of law. And if the child has this tremendous over-identification from the mother or the father, and it can work both ways, but with little children it's often the mom, it is the recipe for rebellion, disaster, loss, and terrible things. Now, why do people over-identify? Well, usually in marriage, and this is not a marriage counseling class, but if the relationship between the husband and the wife is perfunctory, is lacking in, let us simply call, warmth. If the relationship between the husband and wife goes through an fairly protracted period of relative dryness or lack of real feeling or whatever you want to call it, the affections have to go somewhere. And so with the mother, characteristically, with a little child, they go towards the child. Whenever someone tells me, you know, I didn't have any idea. I was a lawyer for 15 years, and I married him, and we've had this baby, and I just didn't know I could fall in love with my child. The moment he was brought in the heater, what's it called, you know, the bassinet, I just fell in love with my son. And of course, at that point, I get to say, oh, no, I understand how you feel. Part of you is supposed to feel that way, but the metaphor is flawed. The metaphor is flawed. It's a metaphor that has potential tremendous over-identification. And what the man does is he feels chilled, he feels cold, he feels moved out, and not really the center, and he becomes, puts his thumb in his mouth. Now, this didn't happen to you or when you first had a child, but it did happen to your husband. He put his thumb in his mouth, and he just decided to be sort of stubborn and passive-aggressive, and he plowed his time into his work. And then you have these marriages which are vulnerable to very, very real and immense human relational problems. And the children will ultimately pay the cost of this. Remember what the divorce rate is. I don't need to remind you. You have children yourselves. You've been through it. But the what I was saying was first over-identification, which is normal but is not helpful, and secondly, the fact that the child-rearing is deeply about the marriage. And if the marriage is weak in the horizontal sense, then the wrong kinds of attachments will develop, and you'll have tremendous heavy weather. It's the origin of psycho, which is the extreme end of parenting, but not at all uncommon, believe it or not, in life, although it never goes to that extent. I used to have, where I was a dean, there was I not only had a big bathroom, I had a large bathroom with a shower that the dean of the cathedral had, and it was a big thing, but I opened it up to other members of staff because I thought it was ridiculous to have this just for myself. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But I got a big towel with blood stains all over it, artificial blood stains, a huge, huge beach towel, and it said the Bates Motel. I thought it was hysterical, but you know, again, they didn't laugh either. So, but I wanted to talk about law comes in when you project an idea of yourself on your children, or somehow that they represent the hopes in life that you have. Maybe you're compensating for something, or you hope that your child will have a future that you didn't have, or you hope that your child won't have the same kind of unattentive father that you had, or overly this, that, or the other mother, and so you try to compensate, and you're hoping that your child will turn out differently than you yourself did, you see. And that's a kind of projection, which is the law. And this is why children have to leave. It's not an optional extra. They must break away according to the law of freedom and individual vitality. Now, I want to now talk about one other thing. And then I'm done, and I'll open it up, and I'll ask Mary if she wants to have anything. I want to give you three other thoughts. 1, 2, 3. About raising small children, the first is, it's absolutely crucial. Grace means, I'm going to sound a little 70s now. No, I'm not supposed to say that, Mary. That sounds like I'm defensive. Grace means being in touch with your inner child. Grace means being so in touch with your own child that you can be funny, delightful, and odd, and humorous, and not serious with your children. Now, this takes many forms. Boy Scouting is one of the best things that has ever been invented. I mean, in a way, it's ridiculous activity. You know, you climb another mountain, you know, it's sort of all kind of a... It's something that really has no real, I mean, it's like a lot of things. There's no real, it's all sort of arbitrary. You know, all those medals you get and everything. But it brings the father and the child together for extended periods of time away. And it is brilliant. Now, with me and our children, the inner child was sharing rock and roll and 1960s science fiction television shows with our children. But as Mary says, Paul, that was just your eccentricity. But whatever your eccentricity is, follow that with your children. They need more than anything else the fun side, the inner child. And you may think this is sounding, again, sort of stereotypical, but I'm huge on the inner child. I want to know about your inner child. I was asking someone recently, you know, I'm not getting quite enough response. And this person said, well, you have to understand, many people who go to church are too adult. A lot of people who go to church sort of miss their childhood. That's why they're in church. Don't misunderstand. But a lot of type A people who go to church are by definition hardworking and sincere and persisting and have strong ethical bases, all of which I think is great. But this person said, just remember, a lot of them missed their childhood. And I just encourage you to hold on to your childhood radically, radically. And anything that you think is fun will be fun for your child. It can be fly fishing, it can be scouting, it can be rock and roll, it can be anything, as long as it's not contrived, as long as it's what you really love. Be in touch with the inner child and the humorous side of life. And that is worth $1 million with raising children, because it's about grace and not law. You see, law is serious. Law is about career. Law is about logistics. Law is about MapQuest. Just think about the things that are about law in your life. Law is about car maintenance. Law is about tax returns. Law is about mortgages. Law is about checkbooks. All of these things I chose in my 20s to jettison. I'm lucky because I have a wife who is extremely capable. I'm just kidding. I've learned how to do some of these things. Law is about garbage. Law is about the dishes. Law is about what you wear, although that can be a little fun. Law is all the details of life. With small children, forget them all. There's not a baby in sight who will ever remember anything about process. He or she will only remember the fun, the smile. Look at you. Remember the times that you had with your father and mother. The times that you remember as a little child. They're almost always adventures that you had. Fun experiences. You had jokes that you shared. So that is grace in raising children, is the inner child. Grace in raising children is marriages that attend to the other person as being more important than the child. Let me say that. Your husband or your wife is more important to you than your child. This is a very heavy thing to say. A lot of people say it's not that way. And I say, no, it is that way. Your job is the least important. Your child is number three. Your husband or wife is number two. God is number one. But what happens in most people's lives? Your job is most important. Your child is second. Your husband or wife is third. And God, well, there we are. It is exactly the opposite. Mary and I made a big point when our children were little. We would get up in the morning, and I'm not trying to blow my own horn, but we learned from this. We got up at 6, we would go downstairs, we read the Bible, and we pray. We just do it for 10 minutes. You know, it's not some big Reformed Presbyterian deal here. It's one verse, Mark 10, verse 2, you know. I came to save sinners. Mary, what are you doing today? What are you worried about? One thing. Paul, what are you worried about today? One thing. God, help Mary. God, help Paul. Amen. Now, the children knew that that time was sacrosanct. They could not interrupt us. I mean, if they did or they had to go to the bathroom or something like that, we would always say, Mommy and Daddy will be finished in 5 minutes. But this is more important. Our time is first. Your time comes out of that. And you know, you wouldn't believe how many times they thank us for that today. They say, what we liked about it, we were very secure because we knew that mom and dad liked to be together in the early morning, and that was very important, whatever that means. And somehow God was a little tied up in it, although we didn't make them join us, you know. And they praise us now for that. Am I telling you? You're going to correct me in a few minutes, aren't you, Mary? I'm going to ask you to call in Mary. So I talked about what? What? Definitely an admonition. Thank you for that. Now, the last thing I want to say is about mercy with small children. Then I'm going to ask Mary to say something, then we'll take some questions. A lot of people will say to me, and I have written a whole chapter about this in my book. There's a whole chapter in my book, Grace in Practice, about this. A lot of people will say, Paul, I know what you say about grace with teenagers. It works. I know what you say about grace with wayward wives and husbands, or grace in the job. I know what you mean about grace and stress. I know what you mean even about grace in dealing with my impossible brother. But with little children, don't you need to have a lot of rules? People say, don't you have to have rules? And here's where we have to make a very clear differentiation. In theology, there are, what do I want to say about this? There's something called the first use of the law, which simply says you never leave a child walking around a swimming pool without watching her, right? You never let a little child walk around a swimming pool at any time without having an adult watching the child. That in Christian theology is called the first use of the law. It's like law that prevents the world from collapsing into chaos. Like stop signs, or bump. Oh, doesn't Chevy Chase Village have these bumps?
Yeah.
Anyway, I know it's all, be that as it may, they're bumps. But that's first use of the law. Or, you know, if you have a deaf child, there's a sign that says, deaf child. or you have a patent law to protect an invention, whatever you want to call it. That's the first use of the law. And I've never met a child who's come to me later on for counseling who's ever gotten mad at their parents for anything like that. No one's ever said, you know, I have a complex because my mother wouldn't let me go swimming until I'd rested 15 minutes after a hamburger, or 40 minutes. They know that that's essential. Or I hate my father because he made me wear a seatbelt. I've never had that. But I've had something else. The second use of the law is the law that functions as guilt. And even little children know about this. The law that functions as guilt. When a child does a bad thing and huge value judgments are brought in like heavy artillery after they've done the bad thing. I learned this very much from my father. My father was the victim or the object of the kind of Christianity that we really has hurt the reputation of the Christian church throughout the history of America, and it hasn't changed all that much. But when he was a young boy, his dad was a minister, a pastor, and he was about four, and he and a little friend of his got hold of a drum, this was like in 1911 or something, and unwittingly began to play the drum very loudly on the road in which they lived. It happened to be Good Friday. And these were very strong, pious, Lutheran, German immigrant people. And the parson's son was playing a drum unwittingly on Good Friday. Well, you might say, well, all you do is you go and you say, son, this is not the right time to play the drum. Play it tomorrow, and I'll play it with you. But that's not what happened. A beating, a severe beating occurred. Now, wouldn't you think that something that happens to a four-year-old kid, because children are resilient, would have sort of slipped away? My father became an atheist that day. That day. He never actually said it quite as baldly as I am, but the groundwork was laid, because he was an atheist. He said he was an atheist. He never changed. The groundwork was laid by a minister father who spanked him mercilessly in his mind on Good Friday. That child became an atheist. Now that's what I'm talking about with disciplining children. It's one thing to pull a child away from a potential accident. It's one thing to be very watchful over children who require parents to make sure that they don't stick their finger in a socket and get electrocuted or break something in a utilities garage or something. It's quite another thing to attach this second use, the judging use of the law, and killing the child's whole picture of fathers and mothers. And I saw it in my family, and I've seen it in countless people. I cannot tell you the number of people who are not sitting here tonight who have told me the reason I don't go to church is because the priest da-da-da-da-da-da-da, or because my mother was sort of like Piper Laurie's character in Carrie, the Brian De Palma 1974 movie. You know, this intense Christian who is just totally on her teenage daughter, as opposed to truly trying to stand in the place of her teenage daughter. And that kind of caricature actually happens when you attach moral judgments to things that are simply normal for young people or children, and it kills the relationship with the father or mother, and it kills the relationship with God. Okay, teachers are fortunate, by the way, because they are surrogate parents. One of the things that Mary and I always did from the time our children were babies, we said, Lord, help our children when it is the right time to go into therapy. This was the thing we constantly prayed. She's kidding, we didn't really do that, but I say that. But what it mean? What do I say by that joke? Provide, O Lord, a surrogate father for my son. Provide a surrogate mother for my daughter. Because I may not be given, because I am the natural father or mother, to be this at a particular stage when the child is in some trouble. Provide, O Lord, a surrogate father or mother. This is why youth workers, for example, in churches are crucial. It has nothing to do with religious teaching, although that is part of it. It has to do with being a surrogate mother or father. That's why we have youth workers in churches. It has to do with being a teacher. A teacher of a little child is in a completely different category than the mother or the father, and can often be the bearer of grace that a parent is unable to be because we're over-invested. What about a coach? Anyone here ever had a coach that functioned as a surrogate father or a surrogate mother? You did. Because grace, when the child is feeling incredibly lacking in confidence, you need a surrogate. I am a surrogate father. I don't mind. I mean, I have to be careful about this. It's a temporary surrogacy. But when people come to me, what it has nothing to do with me personally. If I'm okay, I'm in the position of being able to mediate a paternal or avuncular loving God that they might not be able to get from another place. And that's why being a minister is both a beautiful and a great responsibility. But it exists in all the helping professions. Nurses. I was really sick about 2 years ago. It was a stress-related illness, but it put me in the hospital, and it was not psychological. It was stress-related, but it was half psychological and half physical. And it was dreadful. And I had this, have you ever been bathed in the hospital using this, it's not water? They had this stuff, what was it called? You know, Mayor, it was like they, whatever it was, he put all this stuff on me. I felt like I was in a Star Trek medical situation. And I was not feeling well, to say the least. And he bathed me, this guy, with whatever it was. And it was really great. It was like when you get your hair done, if you've ever been really sick and you want to have your hair washed. And I just about wanted to give him what little money I have. I felt like Bill Murray. Remember when Bill Murray in that movie Groundhog Day, and he goes to the woman and says, can you give me a piano lesson? And she says, I already have a student here. And he says, oh, here's $1,000. I felt like the guy. I was so touched. Surrogate fathers and mothers. The marriage. The grace of less identification. And the law of over-identification and attachment, all rooted in the power of the gospel, which understands that the key to human thriving is the taking away of the burden of the law. And that is, in my view, from the Bible. Because what does he say? This is what I'm concluding now. He says, law came in and it increased the sin. The more I told you what to do, the worse you got. And then he says, who will deliver me from this body of judgment? And then Paul is given to say, now there is therefore no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Now those are ancient words, but he says it's like a thunderclap. Now there is no condemnation, for God has done what the law couldn't do by sending Jesus Christ. Now those words are amazing words. And they show that the law is good and true, but can never accomplish that which it seeks to accomplish. Only grace can make you a better person. And only grace can raise a little child who is not predetermined to leave you forever. Sometimes people will say to me, you know, I've lost my daughter. Ever heard anybody say that? Ever thought that way? I've lost my daughter. I can't tell you how painful it is. I lost my daughter. And I always want to say, but I never do, but I can say it to you generalizing, she was never yours. Why did you think she was yours? The moment you thought she was yours, you attached a burden to her that she had to break to live. And no wonder that Sting sang a song that I used to think was a cliche until I grew up. If you love somebody, set them free. Now, Marisol, you have been the real primary person in raising... Oh, grandparents. Thank you. Two more visual aids. Give me the book back. Bring it back afterwards, but that was a loan. But go down to the National Gallery tomorrow and see the pictures. But don't see the one about middle age. It will scare you. It's totally true. Now, if you want to find out about the inner child, see Joe Dante's movie Small Soldiers. It's obviously one of my favorites, and you may think it's a totally ridiculous movie about little puppets, but it has a wonderful relationship of a rather wounded father and a young 12-year-old boy that is very graceful. And this movie Small Soldiers is really terrific, although it's full of eccentricity. Secondly, thing about grandparents are, grandparents are very, very fortunate because they can relate to their grandchildren without the second use of the law or the burden of judgment, because the parents carry the weight of judgment. The grandparents are allowed to be free to love the children. Spoil your grandchildren, spoil them hugely, give them a lot of money, help them buy houses when your grandchildren want to buy their first house, contribute liberally to their college education. When you see them, give them many expensive presents, and read this book. This is the best book, in my judgment, that I've ever run into about being a grandparent. It's called L'art d'être grand-père, The Art of Being a Grandfather, and it's Victor Hugo's last book of poems. It's never been translated into English, but most of you know enough French to read it. It's easy French. David Stanley is a French scholar, as many of you know. David Stanley. I'm passing it around. This is the Flammarion edition, and I think it's Flammarion. Yeah, it's the Flammarion. It's never been translated. It's never been translated because everybody thought, oh, Victor Hugo, he's about big experience. You know what God is about? Well, is a beautiful series of poems about the grace involved in being a grandfather. The book is worth its weight in gold. Finally, if you are a grandparent, the best thing you can do to show grace is not, in actual fact, to play with your grandchildren. That's easy. The best thing you can do is love your daughter. That's the best thing. The best thing that a grandfather can do is help his son. The best, you see it, I see it all the time at airports. There's the grandparents are waiting, right, in the waiting area for the children who are bringing the grandchildren. The grandchildren become the total focus of the greeting. The mother doesn't really greet her daughter. The father gives a very sort of reticent, sort of Anglo-Saxon kiss to the daughter, and they're all all this stuff, and then the poor son-in-law is about 50 feet behind through security with 10 trillion bags and just looking like Sisyphus, you know, just dead, and he's just a means to an end, and the only thing he's really thinking about is one thing. The same thing Victor Hugo was thinking about when he died, I might add. That's all the son-in-law is thinking about, is one thing. That I guarantee you that's all he's thinking about. And all he's burdened, and the daughter is a little bit on the outs. She's not quite sure because she's afraid her mother is going to subliminally lecture her about the way she's raising her daughter. And so there's tension in the air. And the little child becomes the decoy. And it is a terrible state of affairs at Thanksgiving. The best thing you can do for your grandchildren is help your children get away as long as possible. Anyway, did anyone do have an ovation on that, Noel? Okay. Now, I do want to say that we have a wonderful family life of ministries. We are very focused on families with children here. We love everybody, but we're definitely focused also on small children. And this brochure is in the back, and it tells some of the things that we try to do to help mothers and fathers with small kids. Now, Mary, if you want to add, I'm done. Would you like to say something to give any perspective, and then we'll open it to questions? I can't hear a word you're saying.
Just one little bit of clarification of how it is that this over-identification is the law. It's because it's linked to performance. And anything that's linked to performance is the law, as opposed to I love you no matter who you are, how you behave, what food you eat, you know, how much you embarrass me, and, you know, because you didn't eat what your grandmother made. all those things, if it's related, if it's linked to performance, how your children are doing, and it starts with how bad they are in the grocery store, and it ends up with where they get into college. And you know, or whether they're divorced or not. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. So if your identity is linked up to how they perform, that's why it's the law. Is that, I mean...
Can you give any other examples of that? Like small children that you experience?
It's just mostly, it's just very painful to try to talk to parents of young children because they can't talk to you because they're so living through their children a lot of the time. I mean, just anything of interest that's separate from the children is to be encouraged and cultivated. Just an over-identification that everything is about this. And
didn't you suffer from this yourself as a young mother?
Yes, but I have a certain coolness by nature. It served me.
Say more.
Pardon me to say I was so cool, but I mean cool meaning temper, you know, not cool in a hip way, but cool detached way. I think it's true with, it's different with different children. We disagree a little bit about this, but I think certain children have the ability to, if you have three children, for instance, one child will essentially be fairly easy for you because that child doesn't touch something in you that is, you're able to be fairly matter-of-fact. You're able to not get involved in the second use of the law, this guilt-producing thing, because there, it's a fairly cut-and-dry thing, and it doesn't get all emotional and guilty. But there are other kids that in your family that you're the mother of that have a way of pulling your chain. And it has probably because they're touching something in you. And so that's just very helpful to be aware of. What it is about the different children that are, I'm sure as a teacher, you have certain children that are dead easy for you. You love them, they're easy, and they do brilliantly with you. But there are other children that have the ability to get to you. And you don't do as well with them, and you tend to be more legal, you tend to come on to them harder and more guiltily, and that sort of thing. And it's really your issue. It's not the child's issue. It's really your issue. And God gives us these children to bring up this painful stuff in us that we need to deal with for the sake of the children. So that's all.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for listening. We're not going to go much longer, but now a time for comments or questions about these issues. We have here my beautiful assistant, Vanna White. I say beautiful assistant because that's the common parlance. And she has a mic, and if you have a question or a comment, it'll go on the tape. And we have one in the back initially. Tell me your name again. Dana, we know. I mean, I have met you. Okay. What? Okay, I'm going to turn this off. Isn't this classic? This is classic what happens. It's going off. Now give it to her. Okay, no, you say it first. See if it works. Now say it.
So my question is, once you've described a scene in a Mexican restaurant with a family, and I wanted you to talk about what is that and how does a couple, what do you do to get beyond that.
Okay. Okay. I now turn yours off, and I'll turn mine on. Okay. Dana, what I wrote about this in my book. Mary and I went to a restaurant every sort of our little date night on Friday night. We would go early to a Mexican restaurant that was sort of the slightly upper level of Chuck E. Cheese. And what would happen is we would members, many people in our congregation went to this place, and it was a big place there, and it was mostly young mothers and fathers with small children. Because it was a place that children liked. It was very child-friendly. And it was a great place, and the margaritas were unbelievable. At 8, it would switch and be a singles bar, but until 7, it was for families with small children. And this is what we would see. The father is a slightly overweight, 35-year-old, successful professional person. The mother is a really pretty, very thin, totally together, and a very type A, former attorney who is raising the living daylights out of his two little children. And they are entirely focused on the children, and they would not say a single word to each other the entire meal. Occasionally they might have friends at a neighboring table, but it was all through the children. If you did a diagram, Now, what was the, now, I don't want to be at all, in any sense, I want to say this so it doesn't sound in any way vulgar, but the husband was clearly operating of a certain, operating out of a certain kind of frustration, and he was desperately tired, exhausted, and really very much thinking about feminine companionship. And his wife, she was oblivious. It was very clear to me that she had not the slightest idea what was going on inside him. Because I do. I understood exactly what was going on inside him. And so here's this poor guy who's completely tuned out. She is, she thinks she's doing right. I mean, she's got these little children who are incredibly active and need her terribly much and are making a terrible scene. And there's tacos everywhere. And imagine having children going to Mexican food. It's the worst possible, you know, right? I mean, do Italian. Always do chicken, the children. Do chicken or Italian. But what's happened is there's two things. She is totally involved with the children, rightfully so, but she doesn't have any antennae out, partly because she's so exhausted and partly because she's obtuse to her husband. The husband is angry. He's become angry, and therefore he's not really able to love her very much. What it should be is, he should realize the situation she's in and help her. And then she will inevitably begin to sort of, hey, you know, look at him. But because he's tuned out and feels angry, and she's obtuse, you have a complete, desperate glass wall between them. And that will go on, and it will go on, and it will go on, until something not so good happens. That's why Mary and I immediately, because we've been in the same situation, we immediately developed a tremendous feeling for these couples. Is that, do you identify with that kind of experience? You are those people. Oh, well. Well, let Mary, how do couples get to the other side in that situation of small children? What? Wait, hold on. Mary?
Well, not condemning her for being so focused on the children, and she not condemning. I mean, he's there to help her in those years, really. He's there to give her a break and to understand what's going on with her. If she gets from him understanding, then she's going to love him back. But if she gets from him frustration and coolness
and blame,
then she's just going to get worse.
To turn that off now. Now, Randy.
I just have a question then, which is there a little bit of a chicken and egg then, though, unless I'm misunderstanding the scenario? If the mother is completely involved in the kids, isn't that part of the problem too? That isn't that one of the things that you're suggesting is not the best thing? It's part of the reason the husband is angry is because he's not getting any attention from his wife because she's completely...
Turn that off now. Randy, that's exactly right. I mean, am I wrong here? Is Randy wrong here? This is not the case. I want to be very clear as to not in any sense blame either party because from where they're coming from, it makes all the sense in the world. But it's a... With every couple we've ever known, it achieves crisis proportions after the first baby comes. There's been books written about this, because that's when the guy feels he's sort of out, and he's not prepared for that, and then he gets mad and all those things, and that's why we laugh about it. Mary and I are famous for these relatively R-rated talks that we give together about this, because that's what it's all about when you have small children from the male viewpoint. And then, you know, you go away on these occasional weekends, but don't worry, I won't say anything that's in the slightest unbecoming, but you go away, the mother and father finally get rescued by the grandparents, for a day and a half, and it's always interrupted, you know. We're in the emergency room. How many times have you tried to go away, you know? And the first night you're away, you know, you're finally relieved to have a drink in a little romantic place with a guy playing the piano, and all of a sudden you get a call from your mother that the child is now, you know, has lost 9 teeth and broken a arm and a leg, and they planned it that way. I want to just say this about that. What happens in that, then you go away, what really needs to happen is the wife needs to forgive the husband for being a man. He's a man. He's not a boy. He's not a girl. and the man has to forgive the wife for being a mother and a wife, I mean a woman. It has everything to do with grace and forgiveness. And the moment that happens, and it's a miracle if it does, everything changes. And you can have, in fact, a very happy marriage raising little children. It's rare, but there can be moments of enormous joy. And let's say one other thing. Children are wonderful. I mean, to this day, Mary and I are in critical mourning that we don't have small children anymore. We loved having little babies. We loved it, despite everything of what I've said. Isn't that fair to say?
But a lot of it was
because we had fun. Yeah, we did. We had a lot of fun. There's no question about it. Now, there was a wonderful comment or question. Who was it? Yes. I'm turning this off. Wait, Susan. Okay.
Hello, my name is Judith, and I just listening to you, and I now have my youngest at 21, and I really miss the little kids and everything. But just one of the things that we found out is we constantly had to keep revisiting where we were in our marriage and what we both were wanting. And I do think that a lot of times I was the driving force to say, we need some change here. I can't be cooking every meal. I can't be doing all this. I can't. And my husband was a really good person to listen and you know, he knew sometimes, like he knew that he didn't want anymore to take on anything else himself because he felt overwhelmed. And someone really wise, a good friend once said that you guys, you know, when you do have hard times, you have to work through and then it keeps getting better and then you have to revisit things. But sometimes it looked like you were both like fighting to see who had the bigger burden. And, you know, you both, when you have little kids, you know, if the husband is working, being the main breadwinner, whoever's doing that, has a tremendous burden to take care of the family, feeling that they can make it happen financially. If the woman is taking on more of the burden of the child, or even if you're sharing like we try to do, it never works out a perfect share. And so this whole thing is like, look what you're saying. You guys are both trying to like, who's got the worst life here? And then hearing that, it was just really helpful to hear that and think, you know, then always start looking at your blessings.
Thank you.
And go look, what are all the good things we have? And sometimes I was better at the first. Somebody has to be stronger in the relationship when you're in a down point. And somebody has to take control, just not keep going downhill.
Okay. I don't mean to cut you off at all because that's so great what you said. I just want to piggyback onto that. The competition is death in a marriage, and there's too much of it today. Women are too worried about competitive issues of career in young marriages, and the men are threatened. They're terribly threatened by this. That's why they tend to go to eHarmony to get married. They are too threatened by the issues of competition and career. Whether we think that's the way it is or not, it wrecks marriages, young marriages, when there's too much competition. There's also too much competition for victimization, too much competition for all that. You've got to have compassion for your husband, and he's got to have compassion for you, and that's absolutely crucial. A lot of mercy. As you know, I don't really believe in identity, and I don't believe in identity politics, but that's another question. But compassion, competition kills marriage. And I'm constantly now with young couples, and it's all about competition. And the truth of the matter is, it doesn't mean that the woman has to cede to the man. It means that both have to cede to one another. And that is the secret of a happy marriage, whether you're 25 or whether you're 85. One more comment or question. Noel Bradley. Catherine, you had your hand up and Tom. I'm not sure if we have time, but let's see. Noel, praise God. Noel.
Just so I'm clear, when you're talking about the law, you're not referring to the Ten Commandments, or you are? Because that's what I first started thinking when I first started hearing what you had to say.
The law is the Ten Commandments, but in the book of Romans, Paul says that people who don't have the Ten Commandments, he calls them Gentiles, have an inner law. It's in Romans 2. It's called the law written in the heart. And the law, for Paul, is not just the Ten Commandments. It's any form of ought or judgment. Therefore, for example, the law that you have to be a totally together woman with a great career, a wonderful marriage, and four exemplary children at Holton Arms, just to name one possibility, that is a law that for some people is just as trend-fixing as a law of thou shalt not do this. For some men, the law of career path is as powerful a law as the law not to envy. And these laws crush and kill. And that's, so law is the Ten Commandments. Remember, the law is good. It's good for a man to be successful. It's good for a woman to be able to do many things. But if it's the law, it kills you. And basically, I walk around my entire life like this. Today, I gave an announcement today. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I got on the intercom. Were you there? Well, I got on the intercom, and I said, this is an announcement from the rector. The office is closing in 15 minutes. We're all going to spend the rest of the afternoon taking a nap out on the lawn. And I meant it. I got out there, and Marcia was there. I was there, but none of the staff believed me. Please, everybody, take more naps. Do less. Do less. Yes. You already got one. Okay, one more question. I think, Catherine, I'd like to get to Tom, but Catherine, and then Tom will get you next week. Catherine, last question, and then we're finished.
As a parent of a young child, how do you know the red flags of when you're getting over-invested in that child?
Ooh, how do you know the red flags of when you're getting over-invested in that child, and you are the parent of a young child? Mary, do you have a thought? I have a thought. Did you have a thought? No, what is your thought? Well, whenever I feel totally, emotionally, utterly transfixed by what's happening to that child, when that child either makes me incredibly angry or terribly sad. We had a child who got into distress long, long ago. The child got into distress, and I was heavily over-identified with the child. In this case, it was me, the father. And I knew it because every rock and roll song I listened to that had anything to do with a young man, I would cry. Anything by John Cougar Mellencamp, I was dead, you know. Anything that had to do with dropping out. You know that song by James Brown, Don't Be a Dropout? I was driving once across a bridge in the middle of winter, and it started Don't Be a Dropout by James Brown, and I burst into tears. I knew that I was overinvested because, in fact, you have to let the child drop out. You have to let the child totally crash, praying all the time that God in his infinite mercy will catch the child. But I notice to this day there's certain songs I cannot hear without thinking about that terrible period. So you know because you have, you're angry, or you're crying, or it's all you can think about. You know what I'm saying? It's all you can think about is this particular child and their particular issues. Thank you so much. This is the 4th of 5. I'm going to conclude it next week, and I'm going to talk next week about, and please don't let this disqualify yourself, grace when the roof caves in. Grace when suffering hits. Grace in the face of catastrophe. And hopefully you will be here as someone who is not facing catastrophe. But I would like to speak about grace in the light of catastrophe and how we can be saved in the middle of very serious problems in life. Grace, suffering, and grace and catastrophe. I can imagine coming here at 7 o'clock next week and only saying Mary. But if you know anyone who's going through a rough time, who's going through some kind of a situation that just isn't giving way, I'm going to talk really about mercy and forgiveness in that kind of a situation. And I hope you'll come. Thank you so much for coming tonight, and I'll see you next week.